Gorthandag, and a hearty greeting from England. The Crime Viking here, with a quick plug for my new true crime podcast. And your host, Paige, has been so kind as to lend me your ears for a brief moment, and I didn't even have to raise an axe to remove them first. I have to say, I'm addicted to the Reverie podcast and Paige's magnificent accent. But if you can spare a moment for my show, I'd be forever in your debt. Our first foray into the waters takes us to the land of Mercia, which is a posh way of saying Stoke-on-Trent, England, where Wedgwood and Royal Doulton pottery comes from. Our maiden voyage examines the tragic murder of midwife Samantha Eastwood, whose remorseless killer was likened by police to the infamous Soham murderer, Ian Huntley. I'm on Instagram and Twitter as @CrimeViking. I'm also still taking case recommendations, so it's your chance to steer a course and pledge yourself to a life at sea with your captain, the Crime Viking. Episode 1, now out on iTunes, Spotify, Deezer, and all good podcast hosts. Once again, @CrimeViking on social media. Come, join the Oath Sworn.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Studies show that children who kill their parents usually are split into three groups. Group 1. The children that think their parents are the devil, or that the devil has taken over one or both of their parents. They may even think they're doing them a favor by saving them. Group 2. The children who have mental breakdowns, a severe psychotic episode. They might even be using drugs or involved in other crimes. These children are usually antisocial and or have psychopathic characteristics. Their inability to feel empathy and acting on impulse can lead to accidentally or purposefully murdering their parent. Group 3. The children who have gone through trauma and or abuse. They may act in self-defense during the abuse causing the death of a parent, or kill them while the parent is caught completely off guard. What about the kids that are not in any of these groups? At times, it only takes peer pressure, influence, and a sadistic mind to manipulate someone else into doing whatever they tell them to. It doesn't have to be an adult who puts pressure on children either. It can definitely be another child. Adolescents, occasionally, are scared of rejection, scared of letting their friends or family down, and being shunned. Unfortunately, some kids will go along with anything, even murder, just to put them in someone's good graces, or to go along to get along. This is the patricide of Terry King. Let's begin. This story begins in 1985, when an air conditioner repairman, Terry King, met an exotic dancer and waitress, Janet French. The two never wed, but they stayed together 2 years short of a decade. While the two were together, Janet had an affair with another man. Not long after the affair began, she found out she was expecting. She gave birth to Derek on May 4th, 1988. She and Terry still resided together throughout the affair and pregnancy. On July 12th, 1989, Janet had another son named Alex, and I'm not sure if the biological father is Terry or someone else. Janet fell victim to the underbelly society of the drug scene, and in 1993, she turned her back and walked away from Terry, Alex, and Derek. Janet would sometimes keep in touch, but that contact became few and far between as time progressed, until it stopped altogether. Janet picked up and moved to Kentucky, changing her name to Kelly Marino. Since she changed her name, I'll now be referring to Janet throughout this episode as Kelly. Terry King was doing all he could to support himself and the two boys. It was quite the struggle. Terry was employed as a printing press operator, but he wasn't receiving a sufficient paycheck to get by on. A lot of times, the bills couldn't be paid. As a result, they would go without electricity, their home phone would be disconnected, and keeping food on the table was barely manageable. It wasn't long after Kelly left and Terry began struggling so much that he decided it would be best to take Alex and Derek to live in a Christian home for children. Terry felt it was the responsible and right thing to do for his boys, and he believed the minister who ran the home could take much better care of Alex and Derek than he could at that time, and eventually, they would be put up for adoption or put into a foster home. It could not have been an easy thing to do, but the right thing to do usually is the most difficult. It is better for children to be taken somewhere that they can get proper care rather than stay in a home no matter how much they are loved there, but not being able to eat like they should, to take a bath, and have their basic needs met. It takes a strong person to realize that children cannot live off of your love alone. Eventually, Derek was put with a foster family, the Lay family, but Alex was all by himself in the care of the state. Alex became extremely unhappy and distraught, so a year later, it was decided that it would be the best thing for Alex to go back to live with Terry. At this time, things were not perfect at Terry's home in Cantonment, Florida, but a bit better than the year before. Terry could not afford a babysitter for Alex at the time, so he came up with a plan. Terry put a makeshift bed in his work area, so when he took Alex along to work with him, Alex would have a place to sleep. When Alex was given back to Terry, Derek was still with the Lay family. He began to act out, being an unruly troublemaker, to the point the family could not control or deal with his bad behavior. They could no longer take care of him after 7 years of doing the best they possibly could. Derek was then sent back to live with Terry too. The brothers were readjusting to life back in the care of Terry, who was a firm, authoritarian parent. Alex and Derek had also been apart for a long time. They were basically getting to know each other all over again and reconnecting. Terry was parenting to the best of his ability. When Derek came back, Terry also took him to work with him as well. Neither of the children liked going to Terry's work because they were almost teenagers. They had many other things they would have rather been doing with their buddies. They loathed being forced to go to work with their dad. Eventually, even being at home was getting to be miserable for Alex and Derek. They hated it there. Terry had a friend, Ricky Chavez, who was a mechanic. In the year 2000, Ricky told Terry he could use his yard and his tools anytime to work on his car. Alex would tag along when Terry would go to work at Ricky's. The little boy even began to warm up to Ricky, eventually enjoying going there with Terry and hanging out with Ricky. Essentially, Ricky became somewhat influential to Alex, and soon Derek, who would start coming along to Ricky's as well. Ricky was another male figure in their lives that they looked up to. Ricky also enjoyed having the boys around and was fond of their Three Musketeer-like little bond, which wasn't as sweet and innocent as it may seem. Ricky Chavez had some shocking skeletons in his closet that Terry was clueless about. Sure, we all have our own skeletons in our closets. Who doesn't? However, these were egregious. Ricky not only was convicted twice for robbery, but he had two convictions for lewdness regarding sexual contact with children. To get away from the home that the kids seemed to despise, Alex and Derek began hanging out at Ricky's house in Brentwood, even developing a camaraderie with this older man, while none of them knew, as of yet, that he was a pedophile. As time moved forward, Alex and Derek were at Ricky's house more than they were at their own home. Ricky resided in a mobile home which had an electric fence around it. Drifting teenagers were in and out of Ricky's home all the time. Alex and Derek would go to Ricky's, where there was a secret room. The 40-year-old would smoke pot with the brothers and play video games. He knew how to groom minors and play this sick, predatory game. At first, the boys could not go to Ricky's without Terry, but Terry figured there would be no harm in them going to Ricky's house without him. After all, Terry trusted him. He thought the boys would be in good hands. Unfortunately, little did he know, they were being groomed more and more each time, and Ricky reportedly was very interested in Alex. After a while, Ricky talked the two boys into leaving everything behind to go with him to his home in Pensacola, Florida, which is close to where they lived in Cantonment. They hated being at home, so, of course, the two kids thought this would be adventurous and fun to escape the misery they claimed to be suffering. Terry tracked Ricky down and went to look for Alex and Derek, but the boys would hide from him while Ricky lied to Terry, saying they weren't there. There was more going on than Terry could ever possibly imagine. A little over a week later, the Lay family, who had fostered Derek, assisted Terry in tracking Derek down. Derek had been at a girlfriend's house, and the next day, Ricky took Alex home. On the day Ricky took Alex home, that night was the night Terry would have his life ripped away from him at the hands of Alex and Derek. It was November 26, 2001. 40-year-old Terry spent the night in his recliner in what was called the green room to make sure the 12 and 13-year-old boys couldn't sneak out or run away again. While he was fast asleep, Alex and Derek, carrying an aluminum baseball bat, snuck up on Terry, making sure not to wake their dad up. Derek began to beat Terry to death with the bat, but that was not the end of it. Alex and Derek proceeded to set Terry's bed on fire to burn the whole house down, hoping to banish any evidence that pointed to them being the culprits. What the two didn't know was, half of the house burned down, but Terry was on the side of the house that did not. With their father now dead and the house going up in flames, the two boys took off running to a convenience store to use their phone. They called who else but Ricky. He immediately rushed to get Alex and Derek, taking them home with him for the night. However, the following day, he took the kids to the police station to confess what they had done. Alex and Derek did come straight out and tell the cops what exactly they had done to their father and the house. Their reasoning for doing so, they claimed, was because Terry abused them, mentally and physically. The boys said he would constantly stare them down and spank them. Derek claimed Terry was putting his hands on Alex, roughly pushing him around the night they killed him. They both said they were fed up with the abuse. Derek told authorities, quote, "I was just afraid that once he got both of us back, he would get physical with both of us, at both of us at once." In another interview, Alex stated very nonchalantly, quote, "We looked for a hammer, we couldn't find one, and he pulled the bat out. I think he used that, you know. I thought about it, and I figured out that it would be a better choice, so we took the bat into the green room." They told the police all the graphic details from beginning to end of what they had done. Alex even stated when Derek first hit Terry over the head with the bat, quote, "It was like wood cracking or hitting concrete or something. And so he hits him, and the third time, the bat makes contact with his head. Blood comes from, and he keeps hitting with it, and then he smashed his face in, his skull. Well, normally his skull, his forehead is in line, well, you know, with his nose comes out further than his forehead normally, of course, but whenever he smashes his face in, his nose is smashed in further than his head." There were more interviews with police as time went on, and Derek claimed that Ricky Chavez confessed to them that he had killed a man and nobody ever found out about it. This was discovered not to be factual. However, Alex couldn't stop thinking about that story. Alex kept talking to his big brother about how they should take out their father, but Derek didn't seem like he really wanted to. He kept trying to convince Alex to wait until after Christmas, since they had never had a family Christmas experience, and Derek really craved that. Alex kept hounding Derek about it, saying that was way too long to wait and they should do it soon. Alex said he and Ricky were in a sexual relationship at that time. In other words, let's call a thing a thing, Ricky was basically raping Alex and coercing him into performing sexual acts. The two had oral sex 13 times at the least. Ricky told Alex that nobody else would be able to understand a gay boy like he could. The police found Alex's notebook. The title of one page says, "Written by Alex King, Biography. Do not read. My life used to be cloudy. Before I made friends with Rick, I had a whole lifetime ahead of me, and I didn't know what to do with it. I had no goals. I was confused. What to be? School teacher? Governor? President? What? I thought that was what life was about, but I was wrong. Rick let me see what I didn't understand. Life isn't about having a job. Life isn't about importance. My ultimate goal in life now is what his is. It is about sharing your life with someone else. Before I met Rick, I was straight, but now I'm gay. Love is a powerful thing." Later, the two boys retracted their admissions they made to police, alleging Ricky Chavez kept conveying to them how they should kill Terry for abusing them, and to tell the police they did it out of self-defense. Alex and Derek eventually disclosed to authorities they let Ricky inside of their home that fateful night. They said they hid in the trunk of Ricky's car, as he was inside executing the homicide. They both stated their prior confessions were lies to protect Ricky. In December of 2001, Ricky was taken into custody and charged for being an accessory to murder. For one, he hid Alex and Derek at his home, and for two, in order to rid their clothes of bloodstains, he washed their clothes. Furthermore, he was charged for molesting Alex, and later he was charged with murder, since Alex and Derek alleged he was the actual killer. Ricky's bond was set at $50,000. While in lockup, waiting to be tried, in February of 2002, Alex and Derek were sharing a cell. After Alex cut and bruised his arms, and Derek talked about electrocuting himself, they were put in separate cells. On April 9th, 2002, Ricky was charged with first-degree murder, arson, lewd and lascivious acts upon a child, and he was held without bond. The prosecution chose to try Alex King, Derek King, and Ricky Chavez in two separate trials to strengthen their case against them all. Alex and Derek were tried as adults. The first trial was Ricky's on August 27, 2002. His brother, Michael Chavez, testified to being with Ricky, watching television together the night Terry was killed. Michael said he had the police scanner on when he heard a call to a house fire. At 1:39 a.m., he said the phone started ringing off the hook, and Ricky answered, quickly asking the person on the line what was wrong. Ricky allegedly hung up the phone and hurriedly left the house, returning about 30 minutes later, but he wasn't alone. He had picked up Alex and Derek and brought them to the house. Michael said Ricky seemed dumbfounded and in disbelief. Alex and Derek were toting some clothes, and Derek asked Alex, "Do you want me to tell him what we did?" To which Alex shook his head yes. Derek started to spill the details of what happened, even saying that Terry's brain was hanging out. Derek stated to Michael and Ricky that he put the bat on the bed, then set the bed on fire. After the boys told Michael and Ricky the details, they plopped down on the couch and began watching TV like nothing had happened. A few minutes later, they took off to the bathroom to take a shower, while Ricky washed their blood-stained clothes. Michael said he didn't sleep at all that night out of fear. He had no idea if the boys would attempt to murder him and his brother, too. Derek's attorney had written out his confession when Derek told it to him, and the court heard some of it. Quote, "Rick drove us to a field just over the Alabama line and told us to take off our clothes. We rode in the trunk of his car in our underwear with the clothes to Rick's house. We rode in the trunk so nobody could see us. Rick washed our clothes as soon as we got to his house, and that was Rick's idea." Alex said they smoked pot with Ricky that night and fell asleep on his bed. The day prior, the judge dismissed the charges against Ricky for being the leader of this horrific crime, somehow coercing the boys into killing Terry. Ricky could be found guilty of the murder of Terry King if the jury believed he physically took the bat and attempted to murder him. With Michael and three other witnesses testifying that Ricky was not at the King home when the murder took place, and investigators not finding any proof whatsoever that Ricky was connected to this murder or the scene, this was a serious blow to the prosecution's case against Ricky. His defense attorney went on to say Alex and Derek King meticulously plotted and committed this heinous crime all on their own. Numerous witnesses were called to the stand who testified that Alex and Derek were the only ones responsible for the homicide. three teenagers who were also at the detention center with the King brothers as they were waiting for their day in court, testified that they both told them they murdered Terry. 16-year-old Darren Mathis testified, quote, "They told me that they were in there for killing their dad. Derek told me that he had hit his dad with a bat in his head because his dad was being mean to Alex. He said when he hit him the first time, his eyes kind of flittered. When he swung the second time, he demolished a lamp. The third time, it was like mashed potatoes." Ultimately, on September 6, 2002, Ricky Chavez was acquitted of the murder of Terry King. That information was sealed until Alex and Derek's trial was over. At Alex and Derek's trial, a friend of their mother, Kelly, testified in court saying Derek admitted what they had done to Kelly at Terry's funeral. It had been so long since they had seen their mother that they had no idea who she was until she told them who she was. After that, Derek sang his confession like a canary to his mother. Kelly Marino's friend stated, quote, "He just started to cry. He was very emotional the whole time he was there. At first, he did not say, 'I killed my father.' He said, 'I wish I hadn't have done it.'" While the trial was still happening, their mother Kelly did not mind addressing and speaking to the press. She wanted to get her side out, telling everyone in the media she could that she tried her best to be a decent, good mother. Even when she walked away from her family and the boys were put in foster care, she said she wanted so badly to visit them. However, she claimed if she went to see them, it would mess up their usual schedule, but she always loved them. Kelly believed her sons could not grasp how serious the situation was, the murder, the trial, any of it. She conveyed her sorrow over how her sons were not being tried as minors, but as adults. She said, "They think they're going to a playground. They think they're gonna be with other children." The prosecutor spoke on Kelly's comments she made to the press, saying in court, quote, "Alex and Derek would probably not be looking at prison time had she paid more attention to them when they were in their playpen." Kelly also had two Pensacola attorneys and two Miami attorneys she would show up to court with, which were hired by a celebrity, Rosie O'Donnell. However, the judge would not allow any one of them to participate in the hearing. Security made them all sit in the back row of the courtroom and stood beside them the whole time. Frank and Nancy Lay, who had fostered Derek, testified. Before the trial, they didn't want to go into the details of why they chose to stop fostering him. Now they were ready to explain it all. Frank began by saying how calm and quiet Derek was in the beginning, but over the course of 7 years, Derek became a menace. He started to become fascinated with fire, to the point they had to put away anything he could possibly use to create a fire. It got to a point where the Lay family were a little fearful of Derek. They didn't feel safe in their own home. The incident that finally made the couple stop fostering Derek was when he got his hands on a kerosene container and filled it with gasoline. Thankfully, Frank and Nancy never did light that kerosene container. They found out what Derek did, and they were extremely disturbed and frightened of what he may do next. Nancy testified, quote, "He was full of it all the time. He was always in and out of trouble. Probably just about every rule we put down, he broke at one time or another." At a loss of what to do next, Frank and Nancy came together and decided to talk to Terry. They pleaded with him to let them send Derek to a military school, but Terry said no. Derek was then given back to Terry on September 28, 2001. On November 16th, Derek ran away to his girlfriend's house while Alex was at Ricky's. That's when the Lay family helped Terry find Derek. Nancy testified that Derek begged her not to take him back home to Terry, even letting Nancy know that he and Alex had intended to kill him at some point. The medical examiner, Gary Cumberland, said Terry's skull was fractured in several places and he had large gouges on his face. Derek did say he hit him more than 10 times, but even more convincing that the boys did this and not Ricky Chavez, Alex had described something very well that someone who had never been around someone dying could. Alex said in his confession, his father's breaths sounded like, quote, a slightly stopped up nose, and his face was puffing out with each little breath. Medical examiner Gary said what Alex was hearing was a death rattle, and that, in his opinion, was consistent with Alex being at the scene of the murder. The jury found Alex and Derek guilty of second-degree murder on September 6, 2002. After the verdict, numerous people of the community were angry. Terry King's brother, Greg, picked out Terry's tombstone, and despite it all, he had engraved on the tombstone what he believed Terry would have wanted. It says, "I love you, Alex and Derek." A month went by, and the judge believed the determination to try three people for one crime, while there were two situations that could have transpired, formed a violation of Alex and Derek's right to due process. Therefore, he sacked their convictions. The prosecution and defense mediated and resolved the case so there would not have to be another trial. As a result, the boys pled guilty to arson and third-degree murder in November of 2002. At the time, Alex was 13 and Derek was now 14. Derek said, quote, "Alex suggested I kill my dad. I murdered my dad with an aluminum baseball bat. I set the house on fire from my dad's bedroom. The first story we told police was partially true. The rest was changed to protect Rick. Rick started talking about what we should say to the police. He told us to say we killed our dad because he abused us. That wasn't true." The next month, the boys were moved from the Department of Corrections to the Department of Juvenile Justice, and the prosecuting attorney in the case and Judge Frank Bell were livid about it. The prosecutor, David Rimmer, made quite the statement about them not serving their time in the adult prison. Quote, "The Lady of Justice has been beaten, gang-raped, and left for dead." Down the line, Alex confessed that Terry never abused or mistreated them in any way. Terry spanked them a few times as punishment, and that was as far as anything physical went. Terry never even raised his voice at them. He was financially, physically, mentally, and emotionally doing every single thing he could to take care of those boys by all accounts. Derek was to serve 8 years in prison and received credit for time served. He was eligible to be free when he served 85% of his sentence. This resulted in 20-year-old Derek serving only 7 years, being released from prison on March 7, 2009. Afterwards, he found a community where he could live in Texas. It was a place that gave a home to those who had been in prison for committing patricide. Alex was sentenced to 7 years, also with credit for time served, and he would be eligible to be set free after, just like Derek, serving 85% of his time there. Before he could be released, he attempted to flee in 2005 when he was 15. However, the judge did not add any more time onto his sentence. He ordered that he finish his whole sentence, and when he was released, he was to be on 5 years of probation. Just the same as when their verdict was read and people were angry, there were still many people who believed children could not have committed this atrocious act, and it had to be an adult who would do that due to how violent the deed was. The media was all over this case, and there were more arguments than ever about the trial and the verdicts. One statement from children's rights activist Cynthia Price Cohen personally alarmed me. She said this case hit home for her for one simple reason. Quote, "People look at them and say, wait, these aren't gutter children or those children. These could be any children. They're so beautifully groomed and their hair is cut and they're so pretty. You looked at those innocent little faces and wonder how they could do something so horrible." Ricky Chavez may have been acquitted of the murder, but he was still facing charges for the molestation of Alex, which he denied ever happened. There was not sufficient proof to send him to prison, and the charges were thrown out. Even though he may have gotten away with molesting a minor, he was found guilty as an accessory to the murder of Terry King and found guilty of false imprisonment for washing Alex and Derek's blood-soaked clothes, then hiding the boys after they committed the crime. Ricky was sentenced to 30 years with a concurrent 5-year sentence for tampering with evidence. He will be 72 years old by the time he is released in 2033. Catherine Medico and Molly Barrows wrote a book called A Perversion of Justice, A Southern Tragedy of Murder, Lies, and Innocence Betrayed. In the book, they defended Alex and Derek, attempting to explain how they were innocent. David Rimmer, the prosecutor of the boys' case, called the authors and anyone who believed what they wrote to be factual, quote, naive, and that they may never understand the truth. He also said, "There will always be people who believe Derek and Alex are innocent, just like there will always be people who believe that Michael Jackson is innocent." Sheriff's investigator Terry Kilgore was bitter about the outrage from people who said the case was botched by authorities and Ricky actually carried out the murder. Terry Kilgore said, quote, "We're not idiots. We know how to investigate a homicide." The investigator also pointed out that a vicious murder, for which neither Alex nor Derek showed any remorse, was completely lost in the uproar over the two of them being kids. He said, quote, "I never heard the words I'm sorry, but I don't think Ted Bundy said I'm sorry either. These guys are little Ted Bundys. Ted Bundy conned his victims, these boys conned the public. Everyone thought they didn't do it." When Alex was 18, he was released on parole on April 9, 2008. Back in 2002, he met Catherine Medico, one of the writers of the book that I mentioned. They stayed in communication, and she would go see him while he was incarcerated. After he was released, he went to live with Catherine, who resided in Jacksonville, Florida. Because of his criminal record, on top of not having ever worked before, he couldn't find a job. Alex got his GED while he was in prison, and in 2009 he went to community college. Alex found himself in trouble again in 2011. He violated his parole, which he would have been finished with the next year, and took off running from the scene of a car accident he was involved in while in Pensacola. Alex did receive a 3-year sentence, but again, he was let go in December of 2013, only serving about half of the sentence. Afterwards, he went on to Texas and resided in the community where his brother Derek was living. Alex and Derek in recent years have said they want to move on with their lives, have families, and claim they very much regret what they did when they were 12 and 13 years old. In interviews they have done in recent years, they have taken accountability, and Derek says he will pay for killing his father for the rest of his life. What do you all think of this case? When children make these decisions that are permanent because of an issue that could be handled in so many other ways, do you believe they can serve time in prison, work hard in therapy, and successfully become productive members of society? Do you believe they should get the opportunity to even do that? I know everyone has different opinions, and I always love hearing them. You can always comment on my Twitter posts at Reverie Crime Pod, on Instagram at Reverie True Crime, or send an email to reverietruecrime@gmail.com. There is a Facebook page, but I always update it through Instagram, so I'm never really on Facebook at all. So unfortunately, if you have left comments over there, I haven't seen them. And for anyone who's left nice comments on any of the posts there, thank you so much for that. Thank you for listening to today's episode, and until next time, you know the drill. Stay safe and take care.